Okay, guys, Weekside Podcast. We're in the pre-Super Bowl edition. Jenny and I just got back from the AFC and NFC championship games, respectively, and we'll get into that in a little bit, but first I just kind of want to talk about the matchup. I mean, this is really interesting. I would argue probably two of the best play callers offensively in football, so there's something to digest there, which is entertaining, but I don't know. What do you make of the 49ers-Chiefs? Is it a representative Super Bowl of the NFL in its 100th year? Do you think it's a good Super Bowl, and are you looking forward to it?
Yeah, I mean, I think ultimately these are probably the two best teams that we ended up with in the game. I think we forgot that the Chiefs were one of the best teams a little bit because Patrick Mahomes had the dislocated kneecap and the ankle injury early on, and it took the defense a little while to come together. But once they hit their stride, you know, the Chiefs were kind of right back where they were last January and actually even a little bit better. And yeah, I think you're right. Two creative offensive play callers, but also very different styles of teams. You know, we saw obviously Jimmy Garoppolo's limited pass attempts, and they leaned on the run game with Raheem Mostert and the suffocating defense of the 49ers. But hey, give the Chiefs defense a little credit too. So I think it's an interesting mix, and I think it's, you know, it's fresh storylines. You know, it's a little different. We don't have the Patriots in the game, and I think it'll be an interesting matchup scheme-wise.
I had my radar up for a bunch of phantom pass interference calls that benefited the Packers when I was out at Levi's Stadium because I just thought that the league could not help itself to recreate the first Super Bowl for its 100th anniversary. And as soon as the game kicked off, I was like, oh, this is going to happen. Rodgers and Mahomes and the Packers and the Chiefs and layering all this history on top of one another. And for some reason, you know, I guess this restored my faith a little bit that the NFL isn't a secretly operated puppet show like the WWF or something like that.
I mean, I have to admit, I had chills when you tweeted out that message. You know, I've said too much. Find me in my Signal chat. I'm, you know, curious at these mysterious forces. It was very on brand. But I have to say, Connor, by putting it out there into the universe, I think you maybe negated the conspiracy theory. Like, if you hadn't tweeted that you thought there were going to be some mysterious forces at work to make sure it was a rematch of Super Bowl I, could have been a very different outcome on Sunday.
That's
just want to
true.
Be upfront about that.
That's a great call. I think maybe the 49ers owe me a little bit of a thank you. I mean, I tagged their account in it, so my guess is that went straight to the top of their organization. You know, maybe Jed York was reading that during the game, which is good. I mean, you know, just in terms of it going straight to the top. I'm really interested in, I just don't think I know what the Chiefs are right now after these two playoff games where they both involved them getting behind and then these mad sort of dashes back to taking the lead, led specifically by Patrick Mahomes and almost exclusively by the way that he ran the football. In both of those games, I think he had 50-plus rushing yards, which he's only done two or three times in his career leading up to that. But the 49ers in both of these games seem much more calculated, like the plan that they came in with was superior to whatever team they were playing, and they didn't really have to sweat anything out. And I guess if you're going by like the A plus B equals C thing, you know, the AFC has been an inferior division to the NFC this year. And I'm wondering, like, if we are underrating the 49ers even now going into this game by thinking it's going to be close, or if, like you said before, we just have been kind of overlooking the Chiefs all year, too.
Well, we're holding ourselves accountable here. What was the 49ers reference earlier in the season?
Paper Tigers.
Paper Tigers, right. So I think our listeners will appreciate that, Connor. But that is an interesting point. You know, I did feel like the Chiefs' slow starts were kind of, it was like a drop here and there in cold weather. I don't know if I read too much into it, but there was that furious, you know, surge back. And once Patrick Mahomes scored on that 27-yard run, in which there were five different defenders kind of chasing after him or bouncing off of him or cartwheeling past him onto the sidelines at various points, and that really, the momentum just swung the other way for the Chiefs there. Yeah, I do think the 49ers probably, because I noticed that the Chiefs are slight favorites in this game. So I think the 49ers probably have due course to play the disrespect card a little bit, Connor.
Who are you more, I'm not going to say intimidated or feared, but if you're like a coach looking at this from the other side of the ball, would you rather be facing Andy Reid or would you rather be facing Kyle Shanahan in the Super Bowl?
Well, I'd rather be facing Garoppolo than Mahomes.
That's a great point. Yeah.
That's a hard question to answer, right? Because they've got different play calling styles and both very proven. So as far as the play callers go, I don't know who I would give the advantage to. That is really a tough call, Connor.
Because it's not like last year, right, where we found ourselves saying that, okay, Bill Belichick has so much more institutional knowledge. I mean, by the time that Sean McVay had graduated college and gotten his first quality control job, I think Bill Belichick had won 2 or 3 Super Bowls. And so there was certainly an idea that, like, the gap in terms of wealth of knowledge was significant and just the knowledge of the game and how to prepare for it. I don't think it's that different for Kyle Shanahan and Andy Reid, even though Andy Reid's obviously been coaching for a lot longer. Both of them have been to Super Bowls. Both of them have been in control of significant portions of Super Bowls where clock management was an issue, where they've already made big mistakes. Both of them have been in the league for a long time, and as long as, even though Andy's been in the league longer, I mean, Kyle's dad has been in the league. He's been on the sidelines. So I really don't think that this is one of these things where you can say, well, the age gap is such that the knowledge gap is very wide too.
Yeah, I was thinking about this in the post-game locker room because I hadn't really been in a post-game locker room like the Chiefs in a while. It's just so used to being in covering the AFC Championship game and being in a Patriots locker room where advancing to the Super Bowl is like pretty normal. And last year, you know, I was the AFC pool reporter. So just seeing the Patriots practice all week, it's just a regular part of their season. And so there was that very extreme experience differential last year between a Patriots team that's just used to going to the Super Bowl. It's part of their normal rhythm. They know exactly how to handle everything versus a Rams team that was pretty wide-eyed. You know, there was the shot, of course, of Jared Goff during the national anthem, and you could kind of see that like awe a little bit in his face. But yeah, this was like a very jubilant Chiefs locker room because, you know, they're going back to the Super Bowl for the first time in 50 years. And I wasn't in California, but you were. And I can imagine it was the same thing with the 49ers where it was a franchise that had been, you know, rebuilt. And obviously their gap between Super Bowls is not nearly as long, but just the idea for this new core of players coming together and getting to that game, that jubilation. So yeah, they're kind of coming at it from, yeah, it's just not that same imbalance that you have with pretty much any other team versus the Patriots.
So we'll get into a little bit of both of these teams here right now in the news topics. And just to give our listeners a little peek behind the curtain, because, you know, this is a transparent process. Jenny and I are having the most hilarious echo issues with our microphones. And so when both of us talk, it sounds like we're yelling at each other from like one of those launch capsules in the middle of space. You know, and we're just like, sometimes we'll talk and all of a sudden it'll be like, go, 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 go. So we're having a really good time with it. We're really enjoying it. So we hope that you guys enjoy it too. And that said, for the second week in a row, the Kansas City Chiefs sidestepped imminent doom, this time coming from behind to defeat the 6-seeded Titans at Arrowhead, earning themselves a trip to the Super Bowl. Jenny was live on the scene. What did you make of what was definitely the best of the two games on Sunday?
Well, it was definitely a pretty memorable scene at Arrowhead because there had been the site of so much playoff disappointment for the Chiefs. You know, before last year, they hadn't won a home playoff game in 25 years. And Norma Hunt has been going to the Super Bowl every year since the Super Bowl has existed, and her team has not played in it in 50 years. So it was a lot of emotion. The red and yellow confetti was just like mixed into this orange mash on the field. And but you know who was like pretty just kind of like calm through it all was Patrick Mahomes. Like, saw him sitting at his locker after the game. A couple kids came in with Paul Rudd. I think one was Paul Rudd's son, and there were a couple others. They went up to him and they were just saying congratulations, and Mahomes basically says, you know, thanks, you know, we still got one more, and oh, do you guys want a picture? Like, just like casual guy, like sitting in the locker room. Like, he didn't seem to have, I mean, of course he was excited and, you know, on the podium was hoisting the trophy, but he was just like pretty cool customer, like he always seems to be.
Do you think that that is, do you think that underneath him he's just like exploding inside, or do you think that that really is who he is, or do you think that there's an attempt there to say that, nah, none of this is too big for me?
I think that's just kind of who he is. Although we did see the excitement come out a couple times. Like after he scored that 27-yard touchdown run, he had the Superman arms, and then he kind of walked and pointed at the crowd. Like as he was walking back to the sideline, he was kind of pointing at the crowd. And I thought that was a pretty, you know, actually that might have been after the long touchdown pass to Sammy Watkins, because he was so far behind everyone else, right? Because, you know, touchdown 60 some yards and Mahomes is back there. But there were a couple times that he interacted with the crowd, and I think he does really embrace the whole, you know, he knows that this has been a franchise that hasn't had a lot of success, and obviously they've had success but just haven't been to Super Bowls, and he obviously is the force of change there.
Where do you rank his touchdown run in terms of some of the best plays that you've been able to see in person?
I mean, that was pretty amazing. Like, I saw the helmet catch in person with David Tyree, and I'm not really sure that anything in my mind is ever going to top that. And that happens to be the very first Super Bowl that I covered. So maybe I'm biased because I was just like, just the whole atmosphere. And I was sitting in the aux box, so you were kind of in the section, like among the fans, and you could hear the cheers rather than being behind like a glass pane in a press box. The Tyree moment will always be number one in my book. And this, was an AFC Championship game. But just the way that it swung the game in the Chiefs' favor, and it was basically them saying, like, yeah, we're not letting this get out of our control again. And Mahomes really worked hard in the offseason to be in better physical shape. I think he felt like at the end of last year, he gained a little bit of weight. He didn't have the same flexibility and creativity to make plays out of nothing that he'd had through the rest of the season. And even though he had those early season injuries, I think he is in better physical shape that this time this year than he was at this time last year, and I think it really showed on that run.
I was really interested to I think that, like you said, that's a long-suffering fan base. It's a very loyal fan base. I was there the week prior for the comeback against the Texans, and I was struck by just like the scene there and kind of how loud it can get and how intense it can get. I mean, what was that like just to hear them all celebrate going back to the Super Bowl?
Yeah, and just when they were starting to roll out the stage onto the field. And I mean, the crowd had known for several minutes at that point that they were going to win that game. Like, the outcome was pretty much decided at that point. And just the fireworks that were being lit up all across the city, and everything was painted red. I mean, I think it was a pretty cool, I was there at this point last year, right? And it's awkward when the visiting team wins because they do the trophy presentation like inside the locker room, and at Arrowhead Stadium, there's this very narrow hallway that both teams kind of walk through to get to the locker room. So the home Chiefs players had to walk past the Patriots locker room last year. So to see it the other way this year was pretty remarkable.
Yeah, it was funny, actually. Ben Spiegel of the New York Times was sitting a few seats down from me, and he said, I like when home teams win playoff games. And it had never really occurred to me, how many times we've probably seen, if the Patriots don't have home field advantage or, if something like that happens. And it was like, oh, there was no upsets today. We got to see both celebrations in full bloom, which was kind of nice.
Yeah, it's kind of a cool scene. All right, speaking of Connor, since you were in California, topic number two, the San Francisco 49ers throttled the Green Bay Packers in the nightcap 37-20. Jimmy Garoppolo threw the ball just 8 times, while Raheem Mostert amassed 220 yards and 4 touchdowns against the horrendously bad Packers defense. Connor Orr was on site to drink in what some are calling the birth of an NFL dynasty. Wow.
It was funny. There was a lot of discussion about that, and I cautioned everyone who I heard say that to say that you people were saying the exact same thing in 2011 and 12, and for Jim Harbaugh and Trent Baalke and Colin Kaepernick, and that defense was almost as lauded in a historical perspective as this one has been. Patrick Willis and Navarro Bowman and all the talent that they had on defense, but I don't know. I don't know what will come of this team in the future, but I will say that they ripped through the heart of the Packers defense, and there was nothing that Aaron Rodgers was going to do that day to change that. I mean, I'm stunned to this moment how long it took them to adjust. It was halftime before they started kind of altering the way that they were coming at the 49ers, and I couldn't believe it. I mean, just the amount of times that they only rushed three people, they only had a couple people on the line, and the 49ers are just blowing them out. I mean, every single play, it looked like when Raheem Mostert touched the ball that he could have broken one for a touchdown.
Yeah, and we've heard the birth of a dynasty a lot with the Chiefs as well. And I think we've talked on the show in previous years, Connor, we know with the Eagles and the Falcons in previous years, we thought they have all the pieces in place. You know, they'll be right back here. And even though the Falcons lost the game, but it just seems like it's so hard to project years into the future and figure out what's going to happen. You know, especially with the Chiefs, you've now Mahomes is eligible for a contract extension, which always changes the math a little bit on rosters. But yeah, it was interesting. So I missed a lot of the first half of the second game and had to go back and watch it because the Chiefs locker room opened an hour after that game ended because they had the podium. But then I just remember looking up and seeing like how quickly the score had gotten out of hand. Like it was... Did it ever feel like the Packers were really in it, Connor?
No, and it was, you know, I think Aaron Rodgers, who I went to the Packers locker room after the game to kind of get his feel for, you know, what was going through his mind. But, you know, there was a fumbled snap and they turned the ball over when they were down 14. I think they were down 14 or 17 to nothing. And at that point, I think that's when everybody sort of said, okay, this is over. You know, they could have probably made some plays to get back in it if they had scored on that drive and they were moving the football. But at that point, it was over. And the 20 points in the second half were, you know, just sort of garbage points. I mean, set up by beautiful throws. I mean, there's that, to take nothing away from the Aaron Rodgers and the Packers. I mean, there were some really nice plays in the second half, but to the point where the 49ers knew at halftime that this game was over, and they probably knew midway through the second quarter that it was over. And, you know, it was funny because before the game, people were making such a big deal out of the fact that Kyle Shanahan and Mike Pettine had worked together and that maybe Kyle would get the better of him because, you know, schematically he's a little bit more well regarded in that arena, and maybe he took something from his time with the Browns. And I don't know, you know, I don't really know if that's the case here, but there was certainly an egregious schematic mismatch there. I mean, it was obvious from the second or third drive that there was something that the Packers weren't doing, or something that Shanahan knew that they were going to do that wasn't going to work against them.
I think probably part of the reason that there's this dynasty talk about the 49ers is because, like, we sort of saw the whole arc of the rebuild. We remember when they were 0-8, right, when they made the trade for Jimmy Garoppolo, and so we kind of saw them bottom out and then come back up in the way that, like, the Browns promised they were going to do, right? We actually saw the 49ers kind of do that, and it's like they smartly rebuilt. You know, they traded for Garoppolo, which still was a bargain price, which we all knew at the time. And then they just kind of steadily figured out different ways to build out the roster to specifically fit the schemes that they were running. You know, there was a lot of talk about how Mostert wouldn't have been quite as prolific maybe in a different scheme, but in Shanahan's scheme, he was perfect. They brought in key pieces here or there. One of the final pieces was Nick Bosa. So I think we've kind of, they've had this arc, and it's been pretty impressive to watch, which I think they get a lot of credit for how they've built the team, which is why I think people have confidence moving forward.
All right, so we're going to have plenty of time to talk about these teams next week. Jenny and I will be live from Miami next Tuesday, so we'll have plenty more to get to with these two teams spinning it forward. But for the 30 fan bases out there who do not have anything to do this weekend, I think that free agency news is definitely heating up, headlined by what I think is a phenomenal quarterback class and the actual possibility that these guys will move. You know, you think about years past where quarterbacks have gone into the offseason unsigned, but there's always that, you know, knowledge that they're going to be back with their team, and it's just a matter of, you know, their clubs figuring it out. But, you know, Philip Rivers and the Buccaneers, I mean, that talk is very much alive. Tom Brady and the Raiders or the Chargers or the Bears, I mean, we've heard that over and over again. Could this be one of the most significant off seasons in terms of player movement in league history, Jenny?
Absolutely, because of the possibility that Brady could move and the reality that we don't know at this point in time if Tom Brady will be a Patriot next season. And then, yeah, there's the Rivers question. There's, you know, the Titans have to figure out what to do with Ryan Tannehill. Seems likely that they'll tag him, but there's just a lot of prominent quarterbacks, which is quite in contrast to last year when we tried to count all the teams that had unsettled quarterback situations. And, you know, when Nick Foles was a free agent, there weren't really a lot of places for him to land, right? So this year it's totally different, and there's going to be a lot of question marks on different teams and a lot of big names potentially on the move.
Man, can you imagine if the Jaguars had reached that kind of crisis point 1 year later? Like if they had made the AFC Championship game this year and then stumbled into this quarterback class, like how phenomenal that would be for them. We'd be talking about a completely different situation probably right now, you know?
Yeah.
If they had access to Tom Brady or Philip Rivers, who just moved to Florida. Hello, Florida. You know?
Yeah, I mean, yeah. I mean, I would say that the odds are that Rivers is not a Charger next season. And with Brady, I think it's really difficult to answer that question at this point in time. But I saw, someone raised the point on Twitter over the weekend, and I can't remember who it was or I would credit that person, but it was a smart point, Connor, in that if you're Tom Brady, a lot of the teams being floated, Chargers, Raiders, well, that's the AFC West. Do you want to be going toe-to-toe in the same division as Patrick Mahomes? And maybe you don't.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you're Brady, you find that obvious path, right, back to the playoffs to legitimize your decision. But I'm not sure where exactly that is.
Right.
Maybe, I don't know, I keep pushing Chicago just because I like it. But, you know, the Packers were an extremely lucky 13-3 team. I think the Vikings are going to take a step back, and the Lions have been underwhelming for two seasons now. I mean, maybe that's where you go if you want to make an immediate impact. I mean, entrusting your remaining years with Gruden after he's probably inevitably going to firebomb Derek Carr off the roster would seem a little crazy to me, and that would be sort of a chaotic situation to walk into. But who knows? I mean, I'm a little bit more of a play it safe kind of guy. So,
yeah, and I still think it's very possible he goes back to New England. But in the couple weeks since the game, I think it's become clear that there are a lot of things that will have to happen for that to be the case. And McDaniels returning to New England is certainly a big pro for them, but I think Tom Brady was frustrated at the end of last year, and if the Patriots want him back, they're going to have to surround him with weapons and make some certain, I don't exactly know all the things on his wish list, but I don't think it's necessarily going to be easy for them to get him back, and they have to, Belichick has to want to do all of those things.
You know, it's an interesting question, like, just Brady specifically, what more could they have done for him? And I get that the idea, the wink and nod idea, that he's taken less money over the years, and but I think he did so with the understanding that they were going to spend it elsewhere. I mean, he's basically got a dedicated segment of their stadium dedicated to him and his lifestyle brand. They've been supportive in the launching of his post-career ambitions. His, you know, creepy trainer that weirds people out gets to fly on the plane and gets to stand on the sidelines. And, you know, I mean, I don't know if you're a quarterback, I understand that legacy and that success kind of twists all this stuff, but like, what else are you looking for? And if you want to be surrounded with more weapons and you're mad that the team doesn't do that, what is more money going to do? I don't think that's going to solve any problems either.
Right. No, that's fair. Yeah. I mean, it just seemed like the main thing this year was they felt like they just didn't have enough.
Yeah.
And, you know, I certainly didn't help missing on, or that, the first round draft pick receiver perhaps maybe didn't develop the way they wanted him to this year. I mean, there's a lot of factors in play. But for whatever reason, it was clear from his comments that he didn't feel like he had enough this year, and he didn't, but based on the outcome.
Yeah. If you were a free agent quarterback, would you want to go to New England after Tom Brady left? If you were Andy Dalton, Philip Rivers, would you want to go to the Patriots?
No way, because I'm a chicken.
If I was Tom Brady, I wouldn't want them to go to the Patriots, that's for sure.
Maybe they'll just go quarterback less offense, Connor.
That's now we're talking.
They need a young millennial with confidence, is brimming with confidence. That is not me. I do not check those boxes. But, you know, they need a young millennial that doesn't really like think about it, you know?
Well, Baker Mayfield, the Browns are always open for a trade under their new GM. This one checks a lot of boxes for us because you can't be an overconfident millennial to get some of this stuff, which we weren't back in the day when some of this some of this was being developed and started percolating.
All right, news topic number 4. During the NFC Championship game, NFL cornerback Darrelle Revis tweeted a screenshot of Richard Sherman in action, chastising the cornerback for not playing man coverage and thus not being as great as Revis was. Sherman responded by essentially calling Revis a tired old man and highlighting the very depressing end of Revis's playing career. Is it possible that Revis is right, but due to his presentation, it's an argument he'll never win? Well, I think Revis at his prime was playing at a higher level than Sherman has. However, Sherman's career has been consistently better over a longer period of time.
It's the perfect nuanced argument that Twitter will never accept, right? You know? But I think it's interesting, like, if you're Darrelle, are you just sort of feeling left out right now? Like, is it just, are you watching this game and you're bored and, you know, you just decided to tweet that? I mean, I don't know what was going on when he made that decision. It just seemed kind of weird.
Yeah, I thought it was kind of depressing, Connor, that, you know, I don't know, you sort of wondered, like, why did he feel the need to dive into that fray? But maybe you feel like, maybe there's something under the surface we don't fully understand.
Yeah, a good lesson to players sometimes. I mean, you know, if there is a way during your playoff career to, you know, court and to keep developing your legacy and keep putting it at a higher level. And, you know, there's sometimes a way not to do that. And, you know, maybe during your playoff career, if you think that that's during your playing career, if you think that's something that's going to matter to you when you're done, it's good to realize that early on and then to talk to the people who have taken those very obvious steps, because, you know, there are people who are in the upper tier but not the greatest players at their position but are almost universally considered as such when they retire. And then there are players that were excellent and, era-defining players who miss out on a lot of this stuff and they're not universally loved. And I think that there's a common thread there in how they've kind of and how they act towards the end of their career in, you know, kind of courting the right kind of attention and all of that kind of stuff. I think there's something to that.
You think Revis' legacy is twofold. For a period of time, he was undoubtedly this freakish talent that could truly shut down one part of the field with absolutely no help over top. That is like a rare ability. Mm-hmm. That is a rare feat that he achieved during a window of his career. And then the end came very quickly for him. And he's clearly probably still harbors frustrations about that happening. The second part of his legacy is that he really showed a generation of players how to maximize their worth. And maybe that's not your choice. Maybe you don't want to go from team to team and maximize your worth. Maybe you don't want to hold out. But it's a possibility. And Darrelle Revis, who had the leverage to do it because of the level at which he played, showed players that it's possible and empowered them. And I think that's also very important. And Sherman has had his own legacy as well. And they are both going to be, I think, Hall of Famers. So it just felt petty and it just felt, it just felt kind of sad, you know, like A, is Revis doing okay? And then, you know, B, then Sherman's firing back at him at the podium. And, you know, the focus is on this weird petty back and forth that Revis started, instead of the Super Bowl and, you know, how well the 49ers played that day. So it just was, there was nothing good about it. It just didn't feel great.
Yeah. No, it was. You're right. It was. It was weird. And speaking of which, speaking of not feeling good about things, news topic number five. Odell Beckham's core muscle surgery was labeled a success on Tuesday, which is more than we can say about his trip to the national championship game a week prior, where he slapped a cop on the butt, got a warrant issued for his arrest, which was later dropped, and was chastised for handing out wads of cash to players ineligible to receive it. What does one take away from this strange wanderlust, which followed a very disappointing 2019 season?
That was a interesting kind of swirl of events for Beckham there, Connor.
I just think he's out of, I mean, he has to make it work in Cleveland. And I this is not to say that the Patriots wouldn't take him or the Rams, but I think it's going to now be at a discount, right? I mean, I think there was, when he was leaving the Giants, I think there was this general consensus that, yes, I mean, the Giants are in the wrong, they're stodgy, and that we're going to maximize this talent. And, you know, he's worth every penny, he's worth the first round pick, you know, and there you go, and there you have it. I don't think that that's the case anymore. I think that maybe if the Browns wanted to get rid of him, they're not going to be making their money back on this trade anymore.
Yeah, I think the way that this season unfolded for Beckham affirmed the Giants' decision to trade him, despite the fact that he was this great talent and on a roster that was really desperate for talent with the Giants. And they got a lot of criticism for the move, but then I think he sort of affirmed that, basically, you know, that there's all these other things that come with him, and it makes it hard. And I think he sort of really has eroded the benefit of the doubt at this point. And yeah, you know, it's kind of similar to what we were saying about the Sherman and Revis tweet. Like, it's kind of just like when these things keep happening, like, it's just kind of, you wonder, like, what is the root cause of it, right? Like, you know, with the Revis Sherman feud, what is the root cause of tweeting that after the NFC Championship game? And what is the root cause of Odell kind of wanting to be the center of attention at the LSU game and creating other problems while doing so?
All the videos that have come out since, you know, there's videos of him taking, you know, the trumpet away from someone at the marching band and playing that, and, like, you know, screaming and yelling in the locker room. And most of that was fine. It was good-hearted and good-natured. But every time I went back to college after I graduated, I felt significantly weirder every single time, to the point where I think when I was like 26 was the last time I went back as an aggressive party-going person. And then I was like, oh, never again. Like, I don't know. I'm not cool here anymore, you know? It really felt that way. And not that I was ever cool to begin with there, but...
Yeah, my parents live in the town where I went to college, so I just kind of avoid campus and basically just, like, stay in my parents' house because there's really no need to be hopping around at Cafe 210 at my age.
Well, you know, we'll give it a shot, maybe. Maybe I'll go with you next time. All right, so it's prediction time, it's Oracle time, it's Frentis Consensus time, it's Bachelor time. Feeling a little bit better about my predictive abilities of late, and this one I think I'm going to nail, so I'm very, very excited about this one. My Oracle prediction for this week, for those of you who have not seen this yet, you can go find it on the internet. I'm sure it's everywhere by the time that this podcast posts. The NFL draft is going to be in Las Vegas this year, and the players are going to be escorted onto the stage, which is on a fountain in front of the Bellagio, and the players are going to be escorted onto the stage via boat. There's a very fancy rendering, which probably cost more than my house to make, that was posted on Twitter, to artist rendering that was posted on Twitter today. And so my Oracle prediction is that this is not going to happen. As with most fancy renderings, they are just renderings, and they are the idea of someone at a conference table that you have to listen to. And then once the logistics are proven impossible, that idea breaks down and that person moves on to destroy another part of the operation. And then you put something functional down that actually works for everybody.
All right. I have a competing oracle here, Connor.
Ooh.
I think it's going to happen, and we are going to hear at least one reference when a franchise such as the Bengals drafts a player such as Joe Burrow, and they're ferried across the water to the stage. We will hear something along the lines of, well, we'll see if he walks on water. This is my competing oracle. At least so one good. Show is going to make some lame reference to this.
That is good.
The city of Cincinnati is hoping he walks on water. You know what I mean? I don't know.
No. Do you agree with me though that this feels like a bad business meeting idea where like the guy who pitches all the bad ideas and never does any of the work is like, oh hey, we'll just have them boated in. Look, and then you know, and the distant boss is like, this is a great idea, and then everybody else in charge of the logistics is sitting there absolutely horrified about the idea of making this happen.
Yeah, it feels like a bad sitcom, you know, and you just know that the boat's going to capsize or the episode is going to end in some devastatingly, I was going to say tragic, but really someone will just probably like fall into the water and have to walk to the stage and ruin their suit or something.
Yeah. And then you give Goodell a big wet hug. That's
wow. This is a very interesting one. Very interesting.
All right. Well, this show is not going to come to a tragic end because we have what everybody loves, which is the Frentis Consensus, and then a little bit of Bachelor Talk to round it out. So, Jenny, what do you have for us this week? Something that we're all going to agree on.
I think we can all agree on this one, Connor. Can we just place a moratorium on all of the forthcoming red puns that are going to occur in the coming 10 days?
You're speaking my language.
Two teams that have red uniforms. We've got Big Red. We've got like a red hot offense. Like I'm just my brain is spinning thinking about all the bad tabloid headlines that are ahead of us.
I would say my advice to anybody who comes up with newspaper headlines, and we've seen this process for two giant Super Bowls at the Star Ledger, and then I was working there still when they hosted the Super Bowl, and so we wanted to be the on-field newspaper that all the players held up after the game, and so we had to come up with, you know, catchy headlines. And my advice to anybody that's doing that is, if you think of it in the first 2 minutes, it's probably not very good. Like, and it's probably very original and very, you know, just tropey, you know? So I would say do better, because there's good things out there.
And I really think that coming from two people who have a weekly segment called The Oracle, O-R-R-A-C-L-E, that the wider masses should listen to us because we clearly know our puns.
And anybody who doubts that, Jenny and I last year worked on a laundry list of puns for all the new head coaches hired in 2017. That was probably the thing I'm most proud of producing at the MMQB. And we had like 60 bangers on there, really. I mean, from start to finish, it was just excellent.
Definitely. We missed a window, Connor. At the end of the decade, we should have tweeted out, here are my top 10 stories, and only tweeted that piece. Because it was that good.
What wasn't as good, we talked about this a little bit yesterday. I'm going to keep the Bachelor thing short this week. I think that this show is hitting a wall. It was mostly, the entire show was about subterfuge today. There were women just grabbing Peter and saying, hey, this person is fake and you shouldn't have her around. And then he kicked the fake girl out, but then he wants her back. And, you know, all this kind of stuff, which is just to say that, you know, I don't know. I'm losing touch with this season a little bit. This is only my second Bachelor season, but I'm already like, this is not good. This is not entertaining to me.
I didn't get to watch, but I did see a couple clips where there were some gross mispronunciations of words. There was
lingerie.
Lingerie. And there was another one that I'm forgetting. I want to say that it was debacle, or it was a synonym of debacle by Hannah Ann. I think she, finasco, I think she said, instead of fiasco is what it was. So I just don't really love the portrayal of women in this way, Connor. You know, I mean, just really don't love the idea that women are lingerie wearing non-masters of the English language.
I was stunned that the competition was for all of them to put on lingerie and then to pillow fight each other for Peter's approval. And I mean, my first Bachelor season was a male season, and while you could maybe find some weak links to some stuff that they had done, some hyper masculine like kilt tackling or rugby or, you know, things like that, this was egregious, like, and uncomfortable, basically. I mean, it was just not enjoyable in any sense.
Not really sending a great message for gender stereotypes to the audience. But here I am, Connor. I'm stumbling over all of my words, so I'm really not lending any credibility to the idea that there can be women who do have a mastery of the English language. So
please, anybody who reads Jenny knows that she has a complete mastery of the English language and is someone that I personally text anytime that I can't come up with a good word to find for a story. So for what I'm eternally grateful for. But thank you guys so much for listening this week. Next week we'll be live in Miami, which is very exciting. So be sure to stay tuned to the podcast, and we will talk to you guys at Super Bowl. What are we? Super Bowl 54. 54.
Live. Super Bowl Live.
Super Bowl Live. Shakira, J-Lo, it's going to be great. We'll see you there.
All right. Lots to come. The MMQB Weekside Podcast is me, Jenny Vrentis, and Connor Orr. We are produced by Shelby Royston. SI's executive producer of podcasts is Scott Brody. Ben Eagle is director of editorial projects and product. Mark Moravik is emeritus executive director of the MMQB. Keep up with our entire lineup of podcasts 5 days a week by subscribing to the MMQB NFL Podcast for free on Apple Podcasts. And while you're there, please do us a favor and leave a rating and review. It really does help other people find the show, which is also available on Spotify, radio.com, Stitcher, SI.com, and wherever else you listen to podcasts.